Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is a journalistic legend, Michael Gartner. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. In other exciting news, the documentary Carville, Winning is Everything Stupid, is now streaming on Max. Get updates and some great behind-the-scenes content by following James on Twitter, @JamesCarville, and on his new TikTok, @RealJamesCarville. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at Politicon.com. Tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, Quince, and Naked Wines. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James Carville, Trump is having a honeymoon, even though he doesn't take office for a month. He owns the Republican Party. Mike Johnson's hold on the speakership is totally dependent on Trump. The Senate, unfortunately, is going to confirm all, maybe conceivably reject one of his third and fourth rate cabinet appointments. Business leaders daily are paying homage at Mar-a-Lago, salivating over those expected tax cuts and regulatory relief. You know, consumer and financial protection are dirty words in Trump world. But let me just point out two counterpoints to this MAGA euphoria. One, those businessmen who think the real focus is going to be on tax cuts and deregulation, and he's only going through the motion on massive tariffs and deportations. But for Trump voters, it's the other way around. They like the tariffs, not realizing it would hurt them, and the mass deportations. The other is that some pals and pundits are saying, let's give Trump a fresh start. Let bygones be bygones. You know, let's see how it goes. He doesn't want that, James. He wants revenge. When you file suits against people like Ann Selzer, when you appoint right-wing hitmen like Cash Patel, when you say the January 6th committee is guilty of treason, you're not looking for any kind of common ground. Trump is Trump, and Trump 2.0 is the most dangerous.
Well, I think there are other weaknesses, and I think there's to be an assessment as Democrats try to formulate policy. The first weakness that they have is they barely have a majority in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. I think the way to handle that is talk about they own the entire Congress. They run the whole thing, you know, when in fact, it's like a two-vote majority. I was reading somewhere where, I don't know, somebody might do something else and that might be a one-vote, whatever it is. It's razor thin. We should not accentuate that. We should just say that they're in charge. Secondly, all of the polling I see, it shows that these nominations are starting to hurt them. They're not popular. So if in fact, they're going to get confirmed anyway, which, of course, which you think, and which is a real possibility. I really don't want to argue with that. Maximize their unpopularity. Make them come out and talk about all these crazy things that they did and build a record. And then you can start acting like an opposition party. But the numbers I've seen out of place, it could be different. His approval rate is like 52, which is not very much for somebody just coming in office. The idea that there's this massive public opinion behind him. I think
Obama was 80.
We shouldn't dispute that. But my point is, we should not, for right now, point out that he has a razor-thin majority, that he has unpopular nominees, okay, and that his job approval relative to other people at this time is pathetic. Don't say that. Say he's all powerful. He's got everything. He's in command of everything there is. And that's a hard thing to do, but just say that. That's not exactly a lie. You know, let somebody come back. But Democrats and Democratic messaging, he wants to start with the position that, well, if we lost, we didn't lose by much, so pay attention to us. We didn't lose by much, but don't pay, you know, give them the bit, give them the rein, let them go. They're going to crash into the fucking wall. But I don't think we should dispute the fact that they control the House of Representatives because they control the House of Representatives. All right. We're just speaking up against these cabinet picks, not because we know they're already unpopular, but we want to saddle them with all the crazy crap these people have done. And his approval rating is not going to go up from 52. I'll bet you anything. And we drive approval down by 2026, and that's what we should be looking for, have a different election.
Yeah, I agree. I want to bring up one other thing. You know, we have our list, our favorite list of the craziest House members, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, the Paul Gosars, your guy Higgins in Louisiana, Comer. I'm going to add Barry Loudermilk of Georgia to it, who just put out a report claiming that Liz Cheney ought to be criminally, I guess, indicted or acted upon. What is the charge that so upsets Mr. Loudermilk? I mean, number one, he wants us to think the January 6th insurrection is not what we saw. You know, don't believe what you saw with your own eyes. It really wasn't that bad. It really didn't happen. And the real problem was the January 6th committee, which included Liz Cheney, and the fact that they brought out all these uncomfortable truths. And the charge against her, Cheney in particular, is talking to a witness before the January 6th committee. The witness was Cassidy Hutchison, who was an aide to Mark Meadows, White House Chief of Staff. And Hutchison, in a bout of conscience, decided she wasn't going to just peddle the White House lies. She initiated a call to Liz Cheney about getting new representation. Cheney encouraged that. That is no more a crime. And it's just Trump says the January 6th committee ought to be tried for treason. So all you businessmen who are down there talking to the president-to-be and say, well, you know, he's going to be pretty good on taxes and maybe we can get exemptions for tariffs. Just remember, you're protected by the rule of law. And that's something that is unfamiliar in Mar-a-Lago.
Well, unfortunately, I have a memory. So, first of all, this was in the legally in all these courts can do. There was certainly in the performance of congressional oversight to do that. Every person talks to witnesses before they testify. They're pre-interviewed and they're interviewed by staff, then interviewed right. by committee. I would like to remind people that it was 815 hours of sworn testimony on the Clinton Christmas card list. Okay, understand that, as opposed to an assault on the capital of the United States in which people were killed and many people are already going to jail, it has not quite reached the status of the Clinton Christmas card list. I mean, if you want to know how far we've fallen, that's all you need to know. And I mean, Barry Loudermilk cannot stand the fact that A, Liz is a female, and B, her IQ is four times higher than his. And he just feels really inadequate. And maybe this will give him some sense of adequacy about himself, but he clearly doesn't have
Well,
that.
On that, he's perceptive, James, because he is inadequate. So I give Barry credit for
people
that.
People know it. Yeah, I mean, stupid people know they're stupid.
Yeah,
but I can't get enough of the reference in the Clinton Christmas card list. So to somehow draw our listeners' attention to, there was a story in the New York Times today about how much was spent in the general election. I think over $4 billion was spent on the Democratic side, which, by the way, was considerably more than was spent on the Republican side. Considerably more. They have a chart. All right? We understand that. And then it was our friend Mike Pothurst puts on a kind of biweekly Zoom call or something that people join in and out. And there were a lot of different opinions. And there is this massive pushback that I can discern from the identity people saying that we were not hurt at all by identity politics, which, but honestly, you don't think so? Why don't you go talk to Alyssa Slotkin? Talk to people that actually run campaigns as opposed to running their stupid fucking mouth, which is all you people do. So I think that they has to be, and I future forward another billion. And I think these Democratic donors, and remember the mentality of a Democratic donor, not all, but a majority of them, it's a different mentality than Republican donors. There's not much money to be made on proper Democratic messaging. In fact, it probably, if you're a billionaire, it's probably not totally in your interest. There's much more money to be made by people who pollute than people who are trying to clean up pollution. There's much, much more money to be made by people who want to protect tax cuts for incomes over $400,000 than people who want a tax income. Of course, we never said that during the campaign or raised the minimum wage. And I think when this election is properly put into context, we'll see what is the real cost. But there's also one other thing I wanted to join. This is after spending $4 trillion. PUC, which I like, and I think they're reputable people, no reason to believe they're not, they had a survey. The image of the Republican Party is -2. I think it was 48 unfavorable, 46 favorable. Mm-hmm. After $4 trillion, the image of the Democratic Party is -12. It's like 42 favorable, 54 unfavorable. So not only did we lose the election, all right, we are now 10 points behind in party favorability. This is quite an achievement. If somebody come back and say, well, dang, if you lose, you're 45, a little bit. But this is a huge differential that $4 trillion in spending didn't do anything for. I am a big believer that people should look back. I'm a big believer that somebody should come and do a report, because if we go to the next cycle and we go to raise money from people, they're going to say, well, why would I give all this money last time? And where did it get me? And maybe it did get some things that people can point to. I can't say that, but we ought to say this is what, in retrospect, would work, what didn't work. I think we need to know that. You just don't have $4 billion go and not talk about it.
James, if anybody wants to be further educated on the problems of identity politics, I want them to read a piece this week in the Atlantic magazine, How Democrats Lost Their Way on Immigration. It was written by Cecilia Muniz, who was Obama's immigration person, and Frank Sherry, who I've dealt with for years. I've never known a more committed, a more compassionate immigration advocate. And they said basically, there was a chance to do something on immigration, and the left-wing activists pressured the Biden administration, and they blew it. And it's in the Atlantic, and it's called How Democrats Lost Their Way at Immigration. Everybody out there ought to get it.
They certainly ought to get it. And anybody that questions the absolute unquestionable benefits of transition surgery is going to be called this equivalent of being against civil rights, or being against women having the right to vote. Mm-hmm. And if somebody pointed out, somebody can fact check me, it's banned in Nordic countries. I think the Liberal Labor government of Britain just passed legislation on that question. But you can't, if you say the border, we should have had something different, well, that makes you a racist. If you say that we should proceed with caution on this transition surgery, and not on giving people their right to do whatever they want, then you're slammed. And the tyranny of the left is tyranny. And it not only tyranny that causes people grief, it loses us elections, people. And I got to tell you, Albert, I am the increasing, if people that think this, and I'm increasingly agreeing with them, there is a substantial number of people in a Democratic Party, almost exclusively coastal, almost exclusively white, almost exclusively higher educated, that would rather lose and feel superior about themselves than have to go through the trouble to do the stuff it takes necessary to win an election. And as long as that philosophy is part of the Democratic coalition, it is going to continue to cause unbelievable damage to our electoral prospects. I cannot say it any simpler than that.
You're absolutely dead on. You're dead on. Hey, James, our guest is one of the most distinguished and knowledgeable American journalists, Michael Gartner, former editor of the Des Moines Register, Louisville Courier-Journal, Ames Tribune, president of NBC News, and most importantly, my mentor as the front page editor of the Wall Street Journal many, many years ago. Michael, first, thanks for being with us. ABC News settled with Donald Trump over the charge that their top anchor, George Stephanopoulos, had said that Trump had been, quote, found liable for rape, end quote. The actual conviction was sexual assault, digital penetration, though the judge said it was tantamount to rape. They gave Trump $16 million and an apology. Did Trump have any realistic chance of winning a defamation suit? And why did ABC settle?
I don't think so, because lawyers for big-time media companies, many of them, always say, well, yeah, but it'll cost us less to settle. This thing can drag on for years, or we could lose a jury award for $1 billion or something. I mean, they're not, the lawyers aren't thinking about freedom and about the freedom of the press. They're just thinking about saving the corporate a few million dollars, and that's not the way to do it.
And did Trump have any chance of winning this case?
Well, I don't think so, but who am I to say? I mean, when you look at the facts, it looks like he had no chance at all. But now, you know, it's just Katie by the gate. Now they'll be suing everybody.
So explain why there is this high standard going back to Sullivan for defamation. Why it's so important that there is a very, very high bar?
Because otherwise people would be afraid to print anything and you'd have nothing but press releases. And even those would be gone over very, very carefully. I mean, you have to give some room for mistakes that are not purposeful. So you have to do it. I mean, that's what Sullivan was all about. And that's how it's developed. And that's how we have, up until now, we've had a vigorous free press. But it's being bullied. It'll be bullied today.
Sullivan was a 1964 decision involving the New York Times that basically said you had to prove malice or have a reckless disregard of facts to win a defamation suit if you're a public official. It's something that Trump adamantly opposes. When a big rich company like ABC News settles a case like this, Michael, what impact does it have on others?
Oh, it's just a ripple effect throughout broadcasting and print, you know, or podcasts or whatever. You know, people say, because what's going to happen now is there's going to be more of these suits. And you know, it costs a lot of money to defend a suit. And ABC should have spent that money. Now, you know, if they're going to sue, you know, Art Cullen up in Storm Lake, Iowa, you know, what's he going to do? Just rely on the good faith of a public lawyer or something. I mean, you know, the suits are going to be everywhere. I mean, it's like Ann's deal. They're going to be everywhere.
Well, let's talk about that because it hit home. Trump brought a suit this week against the Des Moines Register and Ann Seltzer for a poll that showed Harris winning Iowa, which she didn't. The three of us know there is no better pollster in America than Seltzer, who has an impeccable record. Every poll says there's a 95% chance it's within the margin of error. What that also says is there's a 5% chance that it's off. This was one of those rare Seltzer polls that was off. Mistakes happen to every pollster. By the way, Trump never complained about the Seltzer poll in January that with uncanny accuracy predicted he'd win the Iowa caucuses by 30 points. But
there's a surprise, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. But this is an extraordinary reach of defamation, Michael. How will this play out?
Well, you know, this is like on a rainy day suing the weatherman. Mm-hmm. Because he predicted a sunny day. And, you know, you can't be right all the time. And she's shot full of integrity. You don't know anybody who's got more integrity than Ann Seltzer and who takes the job more seriously and is more careful and caring. But now, you know, what's going to happen? Now everyone will say, oh, yeah, you know, who believes in polls? But Trump says that every time he's behind in a poll. oh, this poll is crooked, it's rigged, they're out to get me. And now he's done this, and this is going to intimidate pollsters. It's going to intimidate newspaper editors. It's going to intimidate newspaper publishers more than editors, probably. It's just a cruddy thing.
James?
So, Michael Bob, thinking, I don't know if anybody has more media experience and combination of legal expertise, but I want to correct something that you and Al were saying, that ABC News settled for Trump.
Disney
ABC News had nothing to do with the settlement. It was all the Disney Corporation.
Yeah, Disney settled. You're right.
Right.
And as a huge bit, because all throughout the media landscape, people who own media entities, i.e. the Washington Post, have tremendous exposure to the federal government.
Yep.
Tremendous exposure. So, in you know, most every... Yeah, I know the Courier Journal. What year was you at the Courier Journal, Michael?
88, 89, around then.
Did you ever go to Fancy Farm?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, you might be the only two people know Fancy Farm. But how much of a problem are major media companies that are part of a larger corporate portfolio a danger to journalism? And I think you know exactly where I'm going with this. They're exposed on a lot of other fronts.
I ran NBC News for 5 years, and periodically I'd get a call from somebody in Washington or something that says, well, you know, it says Jack Welch says he really needs this protection for his engine company, you know, and we control that. I mean, just not even subtle. And I just say, well, that's between you and Jack. But it's a lot easier when you're just a family-owned company and you believe in the principles and your grandfather did and your father did and your great-grandfather did, and you take as the cost of doing business having lawyers. When I ran the Register, we had 5 lawyers just for that. Every day, any reporter could call one of the lawyers who was posted, chief lawyer on duty that day, and say, can you come down and read this story? Can you tell me how to get this? Can you open this meeting for me? Or these guys have threatened to sue me, or would you read this before it appears? I mean, that's what you do. I mean, that just doesn't happen now.
So, Mike, I'm going to draw on your expertise and give our reasons. So the way that we think the relationship between the media and the government should be, I mean, there's an ideal. I think you, and I know both you and Al have worked your careers kind of trying to stand in that kind of lane where you listen to what people have to say, but you're not intimidated by the government or intimidated by people, and you try to be guided by journalistic principles first. How in danger right now is that kind of view?
It's a whole lot more in danger today than it was yesterday.
Right,
because of the suit against Ann Seltzer. I mean, this is just bullying, and it's trying to intimidate the press, and it will work. It will work.
So, you know? Before I turn it over to Al, I've never practiced law very much. I didn't go to law school, but if I had somebody in with a First Amendment case like this, and the client and somebody said, "Yeah, but under New York Times versus Sullivan, this would not be libelous." That's going to assume that the Supreme Court is not going to change New York Times v. Sullivan at some point. And I think some of the justices have already spoken about revisiting that.
You just hope it's not 5 of them.
Right. But if I was advising a client, I'd say we have to take the most cautious approach we can, which may be that Sullivan is not around in 3 years.
No, the most cautious approach you can take is to fight like hell, because if you don't take that approach, you lose right there. You lose the moment you make that decision.
Right, I agree, but I can see people buckling left and right before this is over.
That's the problem.
Hey, Michael, I want to go back to Ann Seltzer and the Des Moines Register, where you once were editor and president. It's now owned by Gannett, which is owned by a private equity firm. Are you confident that they're going to hold firm in this case?
Well, I'm confident in the lawyer that they've assigned to it. I think it was Tom. I think somebody told me it was Tom Curley. And he's good and he's a true believer. And but the question is, will ultimately the investment company say, this is, you know, we're not going to do this or anything. But I mean, a lot of the damage has been done just by the filing of the lawsuit. And maybe it's not going to intimidate Gannett, but it's going to intimidate a lot of people in small towns and in medium-sized towns.
This is right. Trump is right out of the Viktor Orban Hungary playbook. He came to power in 2010. He filed a whole lot of lawsuits against anyone who criticized him or his administration. Didn't matter if he won or lost because he bankrupted some, others caved. He changed the law, and the Orban Foundation now controls most of the media. There's almost no freedom. And I guess the question is, could that happen here?
Sure. Well, anything can happen here. And that's why this is so dangerous. And you know, this is just, he's not even president yet. You know, the lawsuit says President Donald Trump versus Selzer and Company and Des Moines Register and Gannett and everything. He's not the president of the United States, and he's already filing these lawsuits. And it's just awful. It's just awful, Al.
Yeah, it really is. What do we do, Michael?
Well, the first thing, everybody has to get behind Ann. And help. She's got, you know, there's just this been outpouring of support in the last day and a half for her, and that's great. And she's tough. She can handle this, you know, and she will handle this. And she's not going to cave. And there's no indication that Gannett will, but somebody someday will. And I don't think Trump cares if he wins or loses. He's got all the front page stories on it already. He's already set the standard for bullying on this issue. Win or lose, it doesn't make any difference.
It's Viktor Orban. You know, I'm going to turn it back to James. I have a personal wish, because I think George Stephanopoulos got screwed. I wish he'd quit. He has a big enough name to start his own streaming program or satellite radio and send the message that you cannot work for a place that, when the chips are down, will sell you out.
Did he dispute this? Did he dispute their decision internally?
I have read that he did, but I don't know that. Okay. James?
Okay. Without saying any more, and I have to say, I think the press reports that you read are pretty accurate.
Well, then I agree with you guys. If he was standing up and there, and he turned around and there was nobody standing next to him, I'd say screw it.
So without getting into George's issue, Albert's always been a big believer. I suspect when you were in journalism, you were too. You should have full disclosure. In other words, if your wife works for, you know, XYZ healthcare and you do a story, you point out that there's people need to know this. So now Gannett is owned by a private equity firm. Mm-hmm. And someone asked the editor of the Des Moines Register, will you publish a list of all of the other entities that the owners of this newspaper have? In other words, with private equity, they might have 25 different companies of God knows what.
At least.
Huh?
Yeah, at least, yeah.
At least.
Yeah.
And if I don't know if it's the Columbia Journalism Review or somebody, but all of this cross, I think this is a huge problem, Mike, this cross ownership and not knowing what the vulnerability they're subjected to and the pressure that they have to be sensitive to is to not, and if people don't, and we keep talking about how journalism, professional journalism, people's trust in the news media has declined. A lot of it goes to the right wing, but some of it is, Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. The Postal Service could cost him billions of dollars a year.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's something that needs to be done internally journalism.
I don't think you can pass any legislation that says you can't own a newspaper if you also own a widget company.
Again, I'm saying disclosure.
Yeah, I think you can.
I'm saying that the public, I think you can, should have a right to know.
I think you can I think you can find sure. some way to make disclosure, but they don't want to disclose.
I understand that, but they're writing stories when they are subjected to enormous pressure. I guarantee you that private equity firm, Gannett, is just, it might be, I have no idea. ABC News is not much when it comes to Walt Disney Company in terms of the profits it generates or revenue or anything else. But the Walt Disney Company says, well, gee, I'm going to get rid of this lawsuit. I'm going to get a sit-down dinner with the Trump Street chief of staff. And they tell them, well, we'll give you, you know, 20 front row seats for your advertisers. That's the way to do this, by the way. All right. I've been around this business long enough to know how it operates. And I think this cross ownership, undisclosed, because if I wouldn't want to take anybody out of the market or buy my newspaper or buy my TV station. But I think if journalism wants to rebuild its reputation, disclosure's got to be at the heart of it.
If it if you can force it without messing around with the First Amendment.
Right, I'd rather the public force it than a law, but if we want to know, I read your newspaper, I want to know where it's coming from. I don't know.
Well, you know, a lot of that stuff is available. You know, if you just look at all the federal SEC filings and everything, what they own and what they don't own, how much the corporate overlords make and everything like that, you can get it.
I hope somebody does. Look, thank you. Thank you so much, Michael. Back to you. I appreciate
you know, there
it.
Always is this tendency to say it was better in the old days. That's what, particularly as we get older, we tend to say that a lot. But I'll tell you, when the newspaper world was dominated by the Bancrofts, the Sulzbergers, the Grahams, the Chandlers, the Binghams, it was better. And Michael, we were just fortunate to have been there then.
It was better. When I worked at the Wall Street Journal, it was owned by two old ladies, descendants of Barron, I think. When I worked at the Des Moines Register, it was owned by the Coles family. I went down to Louisville the day for a year and a half to do a favor, and it had been owned by the Binghams, and so it still had those values. I mean, you know, those guys, they had their own pet projects. You know, you cover the symphony really well and stuff like that, but don't pull punches.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, you were a terrific guest, Michael.
Thank you.
Happiest of holidays to you. And
same to you and your family, guys.
Somehow we'll get through this. Take care.
Come on.
Now for the outrage of the week. 4 years ago, after Trump lost, the right-wing money machine didn't sit back and just lick their wounds. They started to fund what turned into Project 2025, the agenda which Trump pretended he knew nothing about in the campaign, and now is at the core of much of what he plans to do. And they funded a robust right-wing media ecosystem and an anti-Biden resistance. So what are their progressive counterparts doing now? Many of them are just sitting out, saying they're despondent or mad about where the national campaign spent billions in the general election. Okay, as James says, let's have an audit. But the more you stay on the sidelines, the more there isn't an aggressive and well-funded resistance to the far more dangerous Trump 2.0, and the less accountability, the more you and the country are going to be scammed. Time is not on your side. This isn't about just Democrats. That's separate. Hey, give me a very small example. Open Secrets, which tracks and discloses campaign money, has to lay off a third of its workforce, which means in the Trump era, where money talks, there's going to be less transparency. There's got to be a couple people who are well-heeled who'll take a look at Open Secrets. It's nonpartisan. We need that information. They shouldn't be laying off. They should be adding people now. You know, we really do face a perilous challenge from a government-to-be that thinks they are the rule of law. And I just don't think any have the luxury of just sitting back and complaining.
So I agree strongly with part of it. I don't disagree so much, but a little bit in approach. First of all, Democratic donors, you're right, they should be funding open secrets now, because we have to find out what went wrong. Okay, that's really, really important. And to the extent these people can tell us how much money was spent, where it was, that's going to help, and help a lot. And of course, they need to come back on the sidelines, but somebody's got to come up, or some organization has got to come up with a plan to say, this didn't work, so we're going to do that. All right. And I don't blame them for being a little bit reluctant to just haul off and start giving money to Democratic campaigns or Democratic organizations. But I do think that Open Secrets should have added this 25% to their staff and get this critical research out that we need to make the right kind of pretensions.
I couldn't agree with you more, James. I'm not talking about giving to Democrats. You know, that's right. a separate issue. I'm talking about giving to groups like Open Secrets and a resistance, someone that follows the terrible things that we discuss they're trying to do to the media. This is going to be an administration that is basically lawless, and some will follow it, but we need help.
My outrage is, and I'm almost certain I'm correct on this, the greatest thing that public health has ever done in the history of public health are vaccinations. It's impossible to imagine two things. How many people are alive today because they're vaccinated? The second one is, so they do the, how do you know, James? You don't know. Because the sample size is in the tens of millions, okay? It's not like you have a drug trial somewhere in Romania and 1,000 people take the drug and 1,000 people take placebo. Tens of millions of people have been vaccinated. And it is a unanimous conclusion that not only are they life-saving, they're some of the safest things you can do. And the idea that we are working to decrease public trust or public appreciation for vaccines is so stupid. It's sickening. It's sickening. You know how many people have had the smallpox vaccination? I couldn't imagine. When's the last time you knew somebody with fucking smallpox? Yeah. Or the measles.
Yeah.
Don't get me started on polio, which and then they try to walk it back. And we were just talking about one. And no, you were not. And they fucking lie about everything. And of course, if you got stupid people, I don't know what's in that shit, James. Oh, really? You don't know what's in that shit? Do you eat an Oreo? Do you know what's in that shit? All right, try it out. Try what's in a slice of bologna, a salami, if you want to see what something is. I just can't get over, how gullible and fucking stupid these people are. I really can't. And how evil it is to tell someone to turn away from or have distrust of the greatest public health initiative in the history of this goddamn planet.
Well, you are so right about that. And to appoint a prominent anti-vaxxer as Secretary of Health and Human Services is just stunning.
I see him out defending it, and it's even crazier than you can imagine. Again, it is not even close. The most life-saving public health initiative in history. It might have saved more lives than every other public health initiative put together. I don't know, clean water, but it's up there with that.
Yep. Okay, we're going to our listener questions. Boy, they just get better all the time. And there's some great ones this week. James Gordon in Norwood, Michigan, says, we have spent 9 years arguing that Trump threatens our constitutional democracy. What are the chances, Gordon asked delicately, that most folks don't give a shit about democracy?
I think it's long as they don't. So our message was democracy. People say, well, I voted. Some must have democracy. Trump won the election. They're not going to sufficiently care, I hate to say this, until a combination and two things happen simultaneously, that some of the pillars of democracy are shaken, and then there's also some kind of an economic crisis. But what people say, well, you know, if it takes ability, you know, so he said he was going to do something about grocery prices when he ran. Intelligent people said there's nothing you can do about it. Of course, once he got elected, then he goes and tells these people, well, there's nothing I can do about it. He said that. And if we start undermining this stuff, and at the same time, you concurrently have some economic hardship, which no one wants to pull for, it'll cause people to rethink. But right now, democracy to a lot of people means, oh, you want them to vote in the cities? Come on, man. You know, you want all these people, all these immigrants to vote? Come on, man. Come on.
Yeah.
You can hear that shit left and right.
Right. No, it's true. Our next question is from Andrew in Jacksonville, Florida, who wants an explanation as to why Pelosi and a majority of Democrats supported Jerry Connelly as the ranking member of House Oversight over AOC. Why back, Andrew asked, a 74-year-old cancer-stricken Connelly over a young, dynamic communicator, which AOC is. Andrew, I thought AOC would be perfect in that role to take on the intellectually challenged James Comer, who's the chairman of that oversight committee, and they demagogue all the time, and she is very sharp. Jerry Connelly's a good guy. Jerry Connelly will do a good job. He has said if his cancer progresses, he will let people know and presumably resign. I hope Jerry Connelly will give AOC a prominent role on that committee, because I think Jerry is, I guess he's been there, I think, James, maybe 9 terms. He's experienced. He's honest. He's smart. He'll do a good job. But AOC has a way to puncture that right-wing nonsense, and I hope she has a big role on that committee.
You know, I'm a little bit torn on this. I actually thought that her candidacy made some sense. Of course, when Ms. Pelosi came out before Jerry Connelly, that woman can single-handedly cause me to reevaluate my position. What I do think is, and I think AOC is, I've never, ever lumped in with all the rest of them because she's smarter, more able, and better staff work. And I think the oversight lane, and I think she's very good at it. And, you know, and I'm sure these guys don't change because, you know, if you start disregarding seniority and relationships you build, you probably create more disorder than not. But I hope that Hakeem encourages AOC, and I think she can be very effective in the coming years on oversight and pointing out all of the abuses and things that they have. So I was for her until Pelosi wasn't, but I still kind of for her on a lot of other fronts.
Yeah, and the House Democrats, to their credit, bypassed seniority and a number of other ranking members, judiciary, where they elevated Jamie Raskin, and agriculture. You know, I think particularly now you got to pick the best people.
Right. So never forget the humane argument. So I'm a Democratic member, and so Pelosi calls me, and she's done a bunch of favors, and I said, Mr. Speaker, I'll do anything for you, but I think we need some new blood. She said, look, Jerry's done a lot for us. He's a really courageous guy. He's, you know, he's in poor health. Why do you want to really kick a guy when he's down? All right. I can understand that.
Yeah.
I'd be swayed by that.
Yeah. Well, I can understand it too. I just hope she I like Jerry a lot. He's a really good guy, and I hope he'll just give her or encourage her to take a very prominent role in that committee.
I do too.
Tony in Lakesburg, California, asks you, James, do you think the tech executives cozying up to Trump realize how easily he is manipulated by what he thinks are his peers so they can influence him any way they want?
Probably right. The guy's a smart guy. Look, if you run, we got to understand something. If you run a company, ideally, this is, we could have a whole program about this. As Milton Friedman said, a corporation only exists for one thing, to deliver value to its shareholders. And there was a lot of pushback, and they have citizenship responsibilities, societies at large. But still, value to your shareholders is, why you're there. The board employs you. The board is essentially looking out after the shareholders. And man, if I'm a big tech executive, if I'm a shareholder in Amazon, I damn sure don't want Jeff Bezos taking on the Trump administration. I really don't. And there's so much conflict. There's so much conflict in the media. There's so much conflict as these companies get bigger and have more variant portfolios. We got to understand that potential for conflict is just exponentially higher today than it ever was.
Yeah, it really is. James, the next question comes from Mary in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
Yeah, okay.
And Mary wants to know, why do Democrats in the media and politics have such a difficult time talking about the massive influence that right-wing media disinformation had on the election? Mary, you make a good point. I think we have been too passive in highlighting this very, very robust right-wing media ecosystem. Michael Tomasky, who was on this show several weeks ago, I think has done it both on this show and the New Republic. And I think it's something that he says that the right-wing media is more powerful than the mainstream media today. And I think that's – who was it? It was Rob Flaherty, who I don't know, was a top advisor to Harris, said, it was pointless for us to talk to the Post or the Times. I think he's wrong on that, but there is a right-wing media, whether it's not just Fox News, it's Sinclair and it's Joe Rogan and it's just, a whole Charlie Kirk. And they almost always sing from the same hymn book.
Well, this is a question that we all speculate on, and the truth of it is, we don't know the answer. What I believe is, it's easy. We can find out the answer, all right? And what that would take is maybe if you did it exhaustively, $150,000, that's it, and do a media consumption survey of the first order. I mean, really get some of the best people in on it. Spend a lot of time, digging into people's habits, because we don't know. When you don't know something, there's a way to find it out. And it is just critical. It's really critical because we're trying to communicate with people and we don't know how they're getting their information. I mean, right now, we still in a 1992 mind warp. All right? It's not like that anymore. And all of the things that you grew up learning probably are not true. Or maybe if you take the media consumption survey and come back to something else. But we don't fucking know, and we can find out.
Yep. Yep.
We can find out.
Yep, absolutely. James, on that, John in Gurnee, Illinois. I think John's a regular. Says, what happened to corporate America standing up for rights that affect the minority? It seems like MAGA destroyed it with their woke and cancel culture attacks.
That was a head fake. All right. And of course, now they're all dropping DEI. And it's like many things that happen in life, as the great Eric Hoffer said, every movement begins as a cause, morphs into a business, and ends up a racket. All right. I could cite you any number of rackets that were done in name of this. But what we have to understand, we completely, this whole show is a lot about this, maybe too much. The corporation exists to return value to shareholders. And I think the overwhelming problem, and that's just the way a corporate CEO is going to think, that's the way the corporate boards are going to think. You know, when you have something like CalPERS or these big hedge funds, I mean, how many shares they have and how open they are to pressure. And when they start owning media entities and other things, you're just degrading people's trust in the whole thing. And it's just increasingly that way.
Yeah, I agree. Tony in New Orleans, James, asked me a question. He said, Al, tell us about your Army-Navy football game experience.
Yeah, let's hear about it. Yeah.
First of all, I love the Army-Navy game. I think it's one of the great sporting events of all times. Just to watch those cadets and midshipmen, 8,000 of them, I'll tell a few stories about it. The bad, first of all, that stadium, which used to be called FedEx Stadium, is now called Northwest Stadium in Landover, Maryland, is maybe the worst football stadium in America. So we had to suffer through that. It was freezing cold. And I, at least, had to suffer through Donald Trump there trying to hog attention, though he did get a big ovation. But I had a wonderful time. I went with my son, Benjamin. I had said I was cheering for Army, a soft spot when I spent some time in West Point. Benjamin, of course, cheered for Navy. And guess what? He had a much better day than I did. It was an underdog team. It's not unusual for the underdog to win. They just beat the living hell out of a very good Army team. And then what I love is at the end of the game, both teams, all members of both teams, first go to the Army side. They lost, and they sing the Army alma mater with all the cadets in the stands. And then they turn around and go to the Navy side and sing the Navy blue and gold. And it really is I don't get very touched by things in sports, but that is really touching. I said I'd probably cry. It was too damn cold to cry. But it was a hell of an event, and Benjamin won a few bucks from me.
It's there was a time when the game was not only a ceremonial game of the First Order, it was actually, but the Army and Navy were both pretty good this year.
Yeah.
And I've seen those games, you know, both of them were like 2-10 or something,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I think Navy had 3 losses, Army had 1 when Army's got 2. It was 5 losses. It was a pretty good brand of football they're playing. And every time that I hear people talk about the woke military, I say, well, why don't you try plebe week? Just go ahead and show up. I bet you if you talk to the commandant, the superintendent, or whatever, Congressman so-and-so just wants to tag along for plebe week. He'll just do everything that they do. And you can find out what the fuck woke is.
Yeah.
By the way, I heard Admiral Stravitas, and but it's something like 35% of, it might be more, of the student body of both the United States Naval Academy and the United States Military Academy are female. And if we did not have females in our military, in our enlisted corps, in our officer corps, we'd be doomed. We would be no recruiting, no, I say manpower, I guess I'm honestly, maybe you say person power, I don't give a shit. All right. The whole thing is so colossally goddamn stupid. It's not as bad as the anti-vax shit, because this kind of shit just makes you ignorant. You don't kill anybody.
James, I'll tell you, we talked about it a lot. About 10 years ago, I spent 3 or 4 days at West Point. It was a wonderful experience. One of the things you find is that 40 years ago, West Point and Annapolis had maybe 1-2% students of minorities, black, Hispanic. And they said, you know, that's wrong. It wasn't just for goo-goo reasons. It's wrong because our beat after graduation is the world. We send soldiers and sailors all over the world. And you know what? The world is not just a bunch of white guys. And what they did, they made a really smart, concerted effort for affirmative action, going to prep schools beforehand. I think they now are about, I don't know if the figures are exactly right, but about 16%, 17% cadets and midshipmen of color. And you know what else? They were good academic institutions 50 years ago. They're a hell of a lot better today. This country is very well served by West Point and Annapolis.
I agree. And I wish one of these sons of bitches would go for that week in June or whenever they show up. See how woke they are.
Yeah, no, exactly. James, our final question from Kelly in Los Angeles, California. Would the Republicans of 2024 have voted for Abraham Lincoln in 1864?
Shit. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? I mean, you know, the more, of course, because our friend Sidney Blumenthal has got this magisterial or some way, call it five volume, on the life of Abraham Lincoln. He's working on number four now. And, you know, the two people that the more I learn about in history, I mean, I always heard of them. They were great, Franklin Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln. But we have no idea how clever and what great political manipulators these people were.
Yep.
I don't know if, but for Lincoln, the outcome of the war would have been different. I think it would have been. And people do not realize we were 60 days away from settling this thing and leaving slavery in the 13 southern states. Okay, if Lincoln doesn't hang in there, and on August 25th, he was ready, he was going to, the next president to come in, it's probably going to be McClellan, and they were going to go negotiate with Jefferson Davis. And then first president of LSU marches in Atlanta and the whole election changes. It just, people need to realize how important politics is to military strategy.
Well, and Lincoln went and named his, he not only named his major adversaries for the nomination, like Seward and Chase, to his cabinet. These were people who thought they were much better than Lincoln,
yes,
and they were going to get it. So, I mean, this was an act
of, Doris,
you know, and they came in and they argued. But Lincoln was so secure in himself, and, you know, Sidney will, is now the resident expert on this, that it made a huge difference in a very, very difficult time.
Yeah, they did. But one of the things, when I look at the Democratic Party, after Chickamauga, which were great Union defeats of the war in 1863, he called Commanding General William Rosecrans. He said he appeared to be like a duck that just got hit on the head. He's dazed and confused. I think if you want to describe a Democratic Party, it's like a duck that just got hit on the head.
Well, anyway, I think we can safely assume that the Trump Republicans would not have had any fondness for Abraham Lincoln. Keep those, please keep those letters and emails coming. If we didn't get to yours this week, send it again and we'll try to get to it next week. Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you'd check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, Quince, and Naked Wines, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.